Hi, this is John Udall. My guest for this week's podcast is Antonio Rodriguez. He's the founder of the photo site called Tableau. In this conversation, we talked about what Tableau is and where it's going. We also revisited one of the topics of a panel we'd been on together earlier in the week. The question was how the social networking features of individual social sites might be combined across a federation of sites. From the perspective of someone who hasn't used Tableau, why are you on Tableau? What are you doing there that you're not doing on Flickr?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. So the nut of it is we see Flickr as the best possible instantiation of a digital shoebox that you can have, in that the shoebox that's in your closet full of those 35mm pictures is what you used to use to store your pictures and maybe organize them with rubber bands and keep them. And Flickr does that much better because it's online and it's collaborative, and they use tags, and they use all sorts of other metadata that people who walk through the site leave as footprints to kind of organize and bubble the best stuff to the top. But when we looked at the landscape, there was really no online equivalent of the photo album, which was the place where you would take the pictures that you cared most out of the shoebox to and paste up in the context of a narrative.
Yeah.
My vacation last summer to Florida, or my sister's wedding, or my son's birth. And with a combination of how you order the pictures, in a lot of cases, text that you would either write in or type out and print out, and layout and design, you tell the story that's in a lot of ways kind of quite different from just shuffling through the shoebox.
The process of telling the story involves selecting photographs, arranging them, sizing them, and annotating them, right?
Exactly, as a start. And then all sorts of design or designy-like things that you want to take on to greater or lesser extent, depending on how you feel about your competence in those areas.
The shoebox metaphor is interesting. In principle, we're moving to a situation where our archives are, in fact, electronic. My daughter walked into my office the other day and saw me throwing away a bunch of stuff, and she said, you know, aren't you going to save that? And I was like, well, no, it's all online. And then I realized how silly that was, because, of course, the truth of the matter is that a photograph or a magazine that's printed and sitting on a shelf is far more likely to be found 25 years from now than something that's sitting on someone's server.
At a previous job where I was working also on layout engines, but ones that were directly tied to rich clients that managed libraries of photographs and let you make one product, which was a physical photo album that you would print and get professionally bound and sent to your home, mm-hmm. The big joke was that we were the ultimate and safest form of archival, and we had a number of customers across all sorts of clients that would literally, every time they had a photograph creating event, would make several copies of a book and feel much safer because of that.
That's quite true. If I went to the trouble of making a Tableau and printing out a great big poster or one of the book formats that you offer, there's a pretty good chance that that would be a more durable kind of thing than any of the existing online locations to which I could save those things. You know, possibly, to be honest, including yours, right?
Right. No, absolutely. One of the things that I think about when I'm not thinking about all the challenges of running a little company, which is like a styrofoam cup in the ocean of ocean liners, is how do we kind of think about not only data portability, but kind of data relevance as you go forward, because we've got all this metadata in terms of layout and story design and where you put things and sort of edit decision lists that you've taken on individual photographs, whether it's for cropping and zooming or for effects. And it's all right now mostly sort of Tableau-specific data formats. And when we try to think about, well, how do we express this as Atom, or how do we express this in some kind of format-neutral way, we end up very quickly hitting a wall and getting to a kind of a required level of investment to really formalize a data format that we just can't justify at this point.
What would you advise someone right now who is sort of straddling this world of digital photography and photo albums, you know, from the past, and new photo albums that are being derived from online images? In the year 2007, what would you advise people to do in terms of thinking about what is the archive for that stuff? Some of it's on your hard disk, some of it's up in the cloud, or it's in multiple locations in the cloud. How should people even think about that?
I find that most archival systems that work on the basis of a relatively simple algorithm, which is increase the replication count beyond which the point of which any one copy being lost can hurt you in any significant way. So what I would advise is leave everything on your hard drive, and if you're really good, you would also back it up, but most people are not really that good. And then put, you know, an online repository somewhere where you can kind of have the second copy there. And then for the really important stuff, this is the weddings, the births, the kind of life-changing events, I would get a hard copy. And the question is, you know, what kind of hard copy do you get? Sadly, most of the kind of 4x6 silver halide prints you can get now, because of how horrendous the economics have become for those, are likely to last less than digitally printed stuff.
Some of the earliest things that I did print with my first color inkjet printer are still doing pretty well. It's been, I'm thinking 10 years in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
Still, it's not 50, it's not 100.
People like Epson and HP have worried a lot about this stuff, and they guarantee their inkjet chemistry to last 100 years and be archival quality, and we don't know, and we'll know in 100 years, but if I had to bet between a Kodak Ophoto 4x6 print, which is being made at a loss because they have to be very competitive with Shutterfly and with Snapfish, or something that comes out of an Epson or an HP printer, I would definitely bet on the latter, just because it doesn't have sort of the same economic pressures to make it as cheap as possible.
We should mention that effectively what Tableau's product is, what people pay you for, are these printed outputs.
Yes, that's right. So what we've done is we kind of look at the output. We look at where you go from bits to atoms. That is stuff that you hold in your hand, because, you know, the internet is great, but you can't really take it to the kitchen and show it to some. Well, you can take it to the kitchen, but you can't take it to the woods or far away from someplace where you can get connected. And we make a set of products that kind of fit two things. One is the community, or the demographic of the community on Tableau.com, the site. And two is a set of products that kind of take advantage of the unique investment that you've made in laying out your photos and text and words in the context of telling a story. So we do print, but it's not something that's super exciting to us, and we do it more because people expect a photo site to do prints. What we get excited about are short story formats like a poster, or longer story formats like books, or, you know, our forthcoming comic book, which will be like a book but with thought balloons and different image effects.
Maybe you should talk a little bit about what a layout engine is and does, and what the lineage of Tableau's layout engine has been.
The fundamental problem that we were trying to solve in Tableau, and the reason why I keep referring to it as a layout engine at its core, is people have all of this digital content that they're creating either via capture devices like digital cameras, or in personal content management systems like a WordPress or a blog installation. And when it comes to making that content look different, either for different forms online or moving from online to offline in printed forms, the kind of tools available to the common person are fairly Stone Age, in that you have to be pretty practiced in the arcane bits. Let me just constrain myself to online for a moment. You have to be pretty practiced in the arcane bits of separating markup from content, and if you want to do it right, you have to know all about CSS and how it works, and I think maybe there are a dozen people in the world that know how to do it just right, and the rest of us kind of muddle along with Firebug. Tableau was supposed to abstract all of that away by letting you just kind of take your gestures in an interface, in a web browser, and then we would repurpose that either for flow-based layouts, which is HTML and most of the online formats, or for raster-based layouts, or rather, you know, coordinate-based layouts, which would be a JPEG or, you know, something that gets printed, like a PDF.
How should people think about the relationship between tools for managing and organizing photos versus the sort of services that you're providing for taking sets of photos and binding them into albums and turning them into narratives? There's some overlap here, right? I guess I could use Tableau really to manage and organize the collection, as well as to do these narratives on top of it, right?
You can, although I would tell you that it become a pretty frustrating experience, because there are just places where the rich client continues to win over an Ajax-ified web browser interface.
Okay.
So if you're going to put iPhoto or Picasa up against Tableau's organizational features, you have to be a very patient man to use us to organize a collection of, say, 10 or 15,000 digital images.
So that being the case, what's been your experience watching people try to negotiate that boundary between having a desktop client, which is the manager, the organizer, and then having some services in the cloud which are providing archival storage, or which are providing the kind of thing that you do? I mean, how do you see people understanding the relationship between those two domains, or not understanding it very well?
For our early adopter user base, there are two places where going into the cloud for this kind of service makes a lot of sense. One is when you're trying to do collaborative work with photographs, because for whatever reason, the rich clients haven't been able to, you know, hook up together as a peer-to-peer infrastructure so that you can share photos and send them around. So if you and I happen to go to a party together and there are a couple of friends there and we want to pull all four of our photographs to make a best of this party, that's where using our organizational and management features makes sense. The other kind of interesting but more fringy areas when the capture device is directly connected to the network. And the specific example here is cell phone cameras. Mm-hmm. So on the site, you can register an email address, and you get a unique email address that you can send pictures from your mobile straight into Tableau with, just like you can with Flickr and a number of other services. Mm-hmm. And what you find is that then we become the primary place to manage and organize those photos because they don't live anywhere else.
At least not at first, right?
They would have to pull them down. Now, on the other side, what are the things that we do that are kind of unique to being in the cloud, outside of archival and outside of, you know, having this virtual printer network that can make all sorts of products that you wouldn't be able to make with an inkjet printer at home? Most of that comes in and around, again, the social aspects of doing this in a collaborative way. One side of it is what I just talked about, which is, you know, you want to collaborate on a book for grandma's birthday, and you want all of the children to put the grandchildren photographs in, and you can do that on Tableau. But the other way is you're going to make an investment, a creative investment, in this work of art that you're making, and you want the ego gratification of knowing that the moment you hit publish and make it public, you're going to get 100, 150, 200 people come through it and see it, you know, as if it were a work of art hanging in a museum. And I think that the kind of emotional reward that at least most of our users, and this is not just the early adopters, but the mainstream users we have on the site, get from that is much greater than anything you could get from any kind of a whiz-bang effect on a desktop image client.
And how do you see people evaluating the choice as to whether to be public or to be just private to the family, to the people who are in the photos?
So on the site now, what we find is that the public content is about 30% of all the content that we've got. So our kind of atom is the published Tableau, which is the online album.
Yep.
And about 30% of those are completely public. And the other 70% are conditionally accessed in some way. And now that can be anywhere from, I've just invited you, John, to one, and so you're the only other person besides me that can see it, to I'm just going to let my entire circle or the people that I've collected in my social network on Tableau see it. And, you know, in the remaining 70%, it splits, I'd say it splits half and half between circle and specific people that I'm inviting to one.
Right.
We kind of made an early bet on spending a lot of time thinking about the conditional access system and privacy settings and letting people kind of slice and dice it, because we thought, you know, it doesn't make sense that we were hearing from people that I go to OPhoto to do sharing with my family and friends, but then I go to Flickr when I want to put it on my blog and have it be more public, because both OPhoto now, though maybe not back then, and Flickr from the very beginning have had privacy levels. So we figured it made sense to kind of try to have something out of the gate that was either easier to grok on the part of the user or kind of provided the fine-grained control that they wanted that the other sites didn't. And it's been kind of interesting and rewarding to see that people take advantage of it and get it, at least a third, a third, and a third.
A third of what?
Roughly speaking, a third really understand fine-grained privacy control,
okay.
And a third kind of have this circle or social network privacy, and then a third is public. We roll up all of your activity on the site into what is sort of a pseudo-blog page, so it's basically your Tableau activity in reverse chronological order,
right.
And we will filter that based on the access control that the viewer is granted. So when I go to see the John page, I may see a completely different set of Tableaus than when your mom comes to see your page because of the permissions you've given us. And that's something that I think people have told us they really like about the site.
We've sort of touched on a question which we were discussing yesterday at the MIT forum around group formation and what goes on within and then across these different social networks. So if all my friends and family are on Tableau, then we all have the same understanding of what the group is and what the permissions are and so on, what the visibility is of the stuff. It's much more complicated when we cross boundaries and our social circle includes people who are on these other services. Maybe I'm just overthinking this kind of thing and it's not that big of a deal for most people, but...
You know, what's funny is that your example yesterday from the panel was the bird watchers group.
Right.
If you're a fan of birds, you know, and you've got your data here and there, and I just by random, I happened to be browsing our site and saw that somebody had created a Tableau group for basically fans of birds photography.
Yeah.
And I went to look into the group, and you know, there's some beautiful Tableaus of photography, but otherwise it's pretty bare.
Yeah.
And, you know, our group implementation is basically a list of Tableaus that people can vote up or the group manager can rate up to be a featured Tableau,
yeah.
And then a forum hanging off of that, and then a member list. And the forum, people can discuss whatever they want. And I thought, wow, this is a perfect example of how this forum could be made a lot richer if we could either synchronize content or just take syndicated content from some other place on the web where people are having these rich discussions about birds or even bird photography.
It shouldn't be necessary to synchronize all of the discussion messages between the bird group on this service and the bird group on that service necessarily, right? You shouldn't need to move the data. You should be able to do this in a more virtual way, by reference rather than by value.
That would be great.
In terms of getting a group like bird enthusiasts who are online to the kind of critical mass where that would be a vibrant culture, you'd like them to have, on the one hand, access to best-of-breed services.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get a kind of service from Flickr, which is different from the sort of thing that they're going to get from, let's say, Tableau, where it's about this more highly produced narrative. However, the services are offering separate group support. There's no easier, obvious way to kind of connect those groups.
Yep. Now, the question here is there any work that you know of that's being done around syndication formats to do this kind of thing?
I'm not sure anything new needs to happen here. I mean, I think we have all the tools.
Okay.
There isn't a service which is purely dedicated to group formation.
That's, yeah, you know, it's funny because what I was thinking of, and I don't want to turn this phone call into a recap of yesterday's panel because hopefully somebody taped that and that was interesting enough in its own right, but the exchange you and I had yesterday about LinkedIn and why LinkedIn derived value from being a gated community or a private network,
yeah.
I was thinking as I was driving out of that event yesterday, is that really true, and can you get that without having to have a gated community? And I thought, what if somebody provided up in the cloud a generalizable access control system that was URL specific? So you could go to it and say, here's an URL, just like you bookmark an URL in Delicious. You could say, here's an URL, and this URL is member by member invite only, and here are the OpenID user IDs of the people that I want to have access to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of along the lines of a generalized service for group formation, but around...
A step stronger than that is, here's a pattern for an URL.
Mm-hmm.
That associates to those people, because
mm-hmm.
there would tend to be families of them, and
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't want to have to enumerate each one. But yeah, I agree. I think, I don't know, maybe someone who's listening to this either knows about or is going to go do
yeah
that kind of thing.
What's nuts about it is I'm sure there's a lot of people that write and build web applications that get stuck on having to implement a cookie-based authentication system for the 9th millionth time, right?
Right.
Because every time you've got to do it from scratch. Now, that's a relatively easy task to do, but it just seems like there are a whole bunch of things like that, and then all the way up to access control,
right,
that you just shouldn't have to do again and again.
Here's a potentially lighter way to think about it. A couple of people lately in comments on my blog have come around to something which I think has been implicit for me, but I've never really articulated it. And it's that the intersection of tags in this abstract space of tag vocabulary is kind of the new URL, right?
Mm-hmm.
In some sense. If I say this tag plus this tag plus this tag,
mm-hmm.
it identifies a cluster of things, and those things actually could have been tagged on Technorati, they could have been tagged on Flickr, they could have been tagged in Delicious, right? So in fact, it's already the case that we have this abstract mechanism for identifying sets of things, which cuts across different services. Maybe it's just a matter of kind of surfacing that to people so that it's more obvious that if you're a bird enthusiast, right, the tag vocabulary in your domain is already a kind of de facto standard, right? And if you just kind of use that, it's similar to what Ed Vilmedi was saying in comments to one of my entries the other day, which is that, you know, I go to these different services and I see the same people, and he recognizes them because they use their same screen names.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a way in which, you know, you can see pulling together a group. It's still sort of just, you know, there's nothing formal about it. It's just kind of, you sort of understand, oh yeah, it's look, these same people are hanging out over here. You feel like you're in the same group, even though you're in another service, right?
Yep. The question though about these ad hoc groups is, do you think that a general user, your sister, for example, would get the whole notion of injecting metadata into a community via tags?
No.
Okay.
And I think that's, in fact, the whole challenge. This, in one sense, is really quite simple and accessible. On the other hand, it's quite abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And so this experiment that I am trying on the community site that I'm working on is exactly about that. Can I get it to become obvious to people that just by tagging something as Elm City and restaurant, that you can put it on your blog, you can put it on Flickr, you can put it in Delicious, you can put it here or there, but it actually targets the same virtual space.
Mm-hmm.
It's quote-unquote just a matter of building interfaces that guide people to that place of understanding that.
You mean by doing things like automatically tagging things for them based on the context of, you know, where they take the picture or where they happen to be entering the review or comment or whatnot?
That would certainly help. You know, we haven't seen much of that yet, have we?
We haven't.
What information do you extract from photos and surface and have available? I mean, I know Flickr's got all the EXIF metadata, and now they've moved into geotagging, which is actually really pretty interesting. And I keep assuming it's just a matter of time before cameras start pumping those Latlan coordinates right into the metadata, right?
Yeah.
Is that even happening yet?
You know, it's not too much. I actually was sent a card by a company that's done a wireless chip inside of an SD card, and they had partnered with somebody to basically get geodata into pictures, and it's the first time I've ever, in 8 or 9 years of taking digital pictures, have had geodata go up to Flickr with my pictures. And I thought it was so delightful to be able to navigate by the geotags once I had the pictures up there, that I asked myself, you know, why haven't I taken the time over the last 8 years of my GPS to kind of enter this data into the, you know, the EXIF header of the JPEGs? The reason is because it's just too much of a pain. So until the cameras are squirting the data, and I don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
What we're doing now is we're using probably the two most critical pieces are date related. Probably the single most critical piece of EXIF data is when the photo was taken. And you really hope and pray that the owner of the camera has set the clock, because that tends to be the main way that people find photos, or at least in their own collection, when you can't expect a big community to be coming through and tagging your photos and helping you tag, you know, 5, 10, 15,000 images.
So this is like the blinking VCR problem, right?
Exactly. although I tell you, one place where I've seen camera interfaces get a lot better is that now the cameras are much more stubborn about forcing you to set that date as you kind of open up the Christmas present before you move on and start shooting.
Yeah.
And I think that that's actually a great thing, because it's one of those things that people don't understand the value of until they're already in the fox, you know, in the hole.
Oh, yeah.
What we've been talking internally about exposing other data, and given where we want to go with a user base of Tableau, which is kind of more into the mainstream, the challenge is how do we expose the data that the geeks here would love to expose in a way that's kind of more digestible by the general population?
Yeah.
And one experiment that I have, although people here talk about how it might just be silly, is to expose focal length, which you have on most modern cameras. So basically, if you have a zoom camera, was the shot taken at 18 millimeters or was it taken at 53 millimeters?
Hmm.
But expose it in a way that it's basically a heuristic for this is a shot of lots of people, or this is a shot of one person, with the simplifying assumption being that, you know, if it's zoomed in, it's likely one person. If it's zoomed out, it's likely lots of people.
That's interesting.
So we'll see. That's what I'd like to play with that. You know, people love to see the AI at work, and most of the time, in my experience, the best AI is the really simplest and dumbest AI.
Yeah. What are your next steps? Where are you in the development pipeline?
The big thing for us over the next few months is we're kind of in the third phase of what will be many major phases of development. The first was, let's put something out there that, you know, is a qualitatively different online experience for doing stuff with composites of photographs and words. And so we did that we launched in June, and we kind of did that up to the launch and then for the first 4 or 5 months of the site. The second phase, which was geared right around the holidays, which is when people want these things, was now let's go to paginated physical products, and let's figure out how you take these kind of long flowing things that scroll forever and make books out of them, which have, you know, very hard constraints on this is a page and this is the next page. We did that, and so we launched a couple of book sizes and a bunch of different poster format sizes. And then coming into the new year, the focus was, okay, now let's take a layout engine and figure out how to do two things with it. One is produce many more different forms of online content. So there's a whole bunch of places where it makes sense to have a JPEG, but you want to have a JPEG that's maybe a composite of several different things, not just a JPEG of one image.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of exploring new forms in the online space. And so not physical products, but things that just make sense as badges or things that go inside of blog entries or things that go on forums, you know, the Birdwatchers forum on Yahoo Groups, etc. And then the other thing we're thinking about a lot is how do we kind of both broaden the tool and lower the barrier to content creation that kind of is most obvious by just not having enough content to start from. So we're kind of trying to think about what content is out there that we can repurpose, what content is out there online, I mean, that we can repurpose, whether it's other images that are coming out of public archives or whether it's text. So an example is, do you want to take a Wikipedia entry and kind of mash it up inside of Tableau and add more imagery than the standard Wikipedia editor would let you do, and then re-export it back out to Wikipedia or any other number of other places?
That's an interesting idea. How would that work?
So the question is, how do we get an RSS feed, or how do we get some kind of syndicatable format of content that we can parse structurally and then take a first stab at how you might lay that out. And then we'll put you into our parcel-based layout editor and let you manipulate the blocks of text just like you would manipulate blocks of text in a Tableau or in a book today. And then let you add images to that, and then let you add the third type of thing, which we don't currently have, but we're going to do soon, is arbitrary parcels of HTML that we hadn't thought of ahead of time. So, you know, here's a div, put whatever HTML you feel like you can put into this div. And, you know, a lot of people do this for things like, say, a Google map. The challenge that we have is, while the form is something that you may actually want to print at some point, you can't allow all kinds of HTML because you may get to something that's just not printable.
What you just said before gets into an interesting and somewhat different area, which is bringing in pages from the web, applying a sophisticated layout technology to do things that, you know, people haven't been able to do with their web pages and turn them back into web pages, is what you're saying.
I have a passion for a class of online tools that I've been really surprised has not gone further in the last 10 years since the Web 1.0. And it's funny because we have some people here from Trellix, which was Dan Pricklin's company that was among the first generation of companies trying to do this. And those that class of tools is basically online page builders.
Yeah.
So online web page builders, everything from GeoCities to Trellix to now Google Page Creator.
What's out there is still incredibly primitive.
It is. You know, the funny thing is, so I've been using Google Page Creator, I think it's called, recently.
Yeah.
And I find that I don't have any hard data on how successful they've been, but I can guess from the lack of buzz that they haven't been, you know, they haven't been a runaway success. And yet the tool is much more functional than tools that have come before it. So I've got to imagine that the reason why it's not a runaway success is because it's just too horizontal of a tool, and it just requires the user to come in with much more than most people who might otherwise put out very good content want to. That is that kind of a general notion of whether you want a two- or three-column layout and a general notion of what you're going to do for header and footer. And if you know all of those things, it's a great tool to use. But if you don't, and you just might be, you might want to write, you know, to your example from before, you might want to write a web page for your town, a web page collecting restaurants. I don't think that type of model is a good model for turning everyday users of the web into authors. And that's kind of where, if it's to the degree that I can, you know, kind of nudge product development, I'd like to see our editor go, which is from this very specialized photos and text to kind of have your narrative to a more general purpose editor for web content that doesn't fall into the trap of if you get to general purpose and you're just an online page builder and for some reason those guys haven't gotten traction, even when they've been well implemented like the Google one.
I suppose part of the reason is that at the end of the day, people only need a couple of formats. So you have your two-column, your three-column, your header, your footer, right? This is kind of what all those things wind up getting used for anyway.
The question is, why do they end up getting used for that? Because people haven't seen alternatives, or is it because formats are some sort of ideal types for publishing that type of content on the web?
I think it's kind of the latter. I mean, I think that the three-column header-footer thing is an almost ideal type.
Huh.
It's certainly pretty much what just about every blog page is, and most major websites follow that pattern.
So they solve the problem of allowing you to have some sort of structure with a flow-based layout, right? Which is a great thing because you can keep structure and then have these infinite pages that can scroll down as far as you want. But I think, you know, if you kind of look forward to the kinds of stuff people will be publishing online 5, 10, 15 years from now, you know, when the generation of kids that are coming out of school now that don't know any other kind of publishing that is not online, we may see new forms that don't quite fit in the 2- and 3-column thing.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, anyway, we should go back to work.
Yes, indeed. This has been fun. This has been the highlight of my day today, John. So I'm glad we got a chance to do this.
I'm glad we did too, Antonio. All right, see you around, man.
Bye.